Today is Monday, September 27th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Germany begins search for a new chancellor.
Olaf Scholz, the leader of the Social Democrats, has already said that he's got the momentum, his party gained the most votes, and the German people want change, and he should get the first chance.
Plus, make or break week for President Biden's economic agenda.
Congressional leaders are negotiating over the timing of voting on a bipartisan infrastructure bill, which would increase spending for roads, bridges, and other projects.
Also, UN documents 350,000 civilian deaths in Syria. Our top story today is in Germany. Germany is embarking on a potentially lengthy search for its new government after the center-left Social Democrats narrowly beat retiring Chancellor Angela Merkel's center-right bloc. The election failed to set a clear direction for Europe's biggest economy under a new leader. Leaders of the parties in the newly elected parliament were meeting Monday to digest the result that saw Merkel's Union bloc slump to its worst result in a national election and appeared to put the keys to power in the hands of two opposition parties. Both Social Democrat Olaf Scholz and Armin Laschet, the candidate of Merkel's Christian Democrats, laid a claim to leading the next government. For more, I spoke with VOA's Henry Ridgewell.
The odds-on favourite still is Olaf Scholz. He's the head of the Social Democrat Party in Germany. But the result is a lot tighter than he had hoped it might be just a week ago. So he is on just his party, got just short of 26% of the vote. And his main rival, that's Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats, got just below 25%. So it's a very close finish. Neither of those main parties have nearly enough vote to create an absolute majority in parliament, which means that now they're going to have to talk to the smaller parties to see if they can form a coalition. Now, Olaf Scholz, the leader of the Social Democrats, has already said that he's got the momentum, his party gained the most votes, and the German people want change, and he should get the first chance to try to form a government. And talks will begin as we speak between the main parties and those smaller parties.
Is this result a rejection of the policies of Angela Merkel, or the Germans just want to change and just tired of the 16 years of Angela Merkel's leadership?
I think the problem is that there isn't one message that has come out loud and clear from the voters. I don't think it's a rejection so much of her party or her policies, but of the voters perhaps not finding a candidate who they find particularly inspiring. The man that they chose to run as the CDU, as the Christian Democrats candidate to replace her, was Armin Laschet, and he's made a few stumbles on the campaign trail, most notably when he visited an area of Germany that was badly flooded in the summer. He was caught on camera laughing in the background of a speech by the German president, and that really hit his approval ratings. If you look at who Germans think would be the best leader, so not necessarily at the election, but when they're asked who would be the best leader, Olaf Scholz is way out in front. But the Social Democrats still only got a quarter of the vote. And then how much daylight is there between the policies of each party? Well, certainly the Social Democrats are centre-left and the Christian Democrats are centre-right, and so they might differ slightly over levels of government spending and that sort of thing, but not drastically.
What are the broad implications of these results within Europe and the entire world?
Germany plays such a key role in Europe. It was one of the founder members of the European Union. It remains at the forefront of every decision that the bloc makes. The engine of the European Union is that German-French axis, and Germany is by far Europe's biggest economy, especially since Brexit, and it has played that central role since that anchoring role for the bloc. Chancellor Merkel has seen Germany and seen Europe through numerous crises over her time in power. Back in 2008, the financial crisis, and then the euro debt crisis with Greece, the migrant crisis, which saw a million migrants enter Germany in 2015, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and more recently the coronavirus. All of these problems that she has helped Europe overcome with her sort of pragmatism and stability, as her supporters see it. So who is going to take on that mantle? Who is going to be that rock of stability, if you like, in the middle of Europe? And of course, that has implications for the whole world as well in terms of how powerful Europe is, how much it will insist on things like human rights clauses in trade agreements, in standards like that, that Europe sees itself as setting globally. How strong will the transatlantic relationship be between Europe and America?
That's Henry Ridgewell speaking with me from London. A time of intensity. That's what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, is calling this coming week in the U.S. Congress, as lawmakers are expected to vote on a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. They also will consider the Democrat-backed $3.5 trillion sweeping social spending package core to Biden's administration's agenda. Michelle Quinn reports.
The Biden administration's domestic agenda faces a major test this week. Congressional leaders are negotiating over the timing of voting on a bipartisan infrastructure bill, which would increase spending for roads, bridges, and other projects. Some progressive members of the Democratic Party say they won't vote for that $1 trillion package unless the bigger $3.5 trillion social spending bill, President Joe Biden's Build Back Better, also comes up for a vote. The smaller bill is likely to come up first, and the cost of the bigger package will likely be cut as negotiations proceed, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told ABC's This Week.
This isn't about moderates versus progressives. Overwhelmingly, the entirety of our caucus, except for a few whose judgment I respect, support the vision of Joe Biden, and we will make progress on it this week.
Yet another issue looms. The government could start running out of money sometime in mid-October. According to a recent report, Congress will have to raise the debt limit so that it can borrow money to pay for a wide array of spending already approved, including the military and Social Security. Last week, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, said the Republicans are not going to help the Democrats raise the debt ceiling, arguing that the Democrats should pass it on their own since they are poised to pass the $3.5 trillion bill, which many Republicans oppose.
Don't play Russian roulette with our economy. Step up and raise the debt ceiling to cover all that you've been engaged in all year long.
But much is at stake. A partial government shutdown could happen later this week if Congress doesn't pass spending legislation. The Senate is expected next to consider a bill which passed the House that would extend spending limits, raise the debt, and provide aid to communities hit by natural disasters and to Afghan refugees. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is defending President Joe Biden's foreign policy record as the administration faces pressure over its handling of Haitian migrants on the U.S. border, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and a nuclear submarine deal with Australia that angered France. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more.
Help lead the world toward a more
President
peaceful,
Joe Biden told the United Nations General Assembly this week that the world is at an inflection point. And he vowed to pivot from an era of relentless wars to an era of relentless diplomacy, with the United States committed to multilateral institutions like the UN. But the recent hurried U.S. departure from Afghanistan, with an untold number of Afghans who helped the United States left behind, is just one of multiple foreign policy challenges the White House has faced in recent weeks. At the UN, Secretary of State Antony Blinken faced some tough questions on Biden's foreign policy challenges.
Chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, this new security agreement between Australia, the U.S., and the U.K. that enraged the French, the border crisis.
Blinken said everyone he had spoken with at the UN has expressed appreciation for Biden's foreign policy vision.
The United States that is determined to work closely with other countries. The United States that understands that not a single one of the big problems and challenges we face that our people face, ones we've talked about from COVID to climate to the disruptive impact of emerging technologies, not a single one can be addressed by any of us acting alone.
But most experts agree the Biden administration has had some foreign policy setbacks, including angering France. Brian Katulis is with the Center for American Progress.
Certainly the center of gravity for this new administration's focus has been at home in dealing with the pandemic and vaccines and the economic situation. So much of the president's personal time, even though he was speaking at the United Nations this week, I think much of his time this week will be spent trying to discuss with Congress and convince them of his infrastructure plan and the social safety net.
Other experts say Biden is focused like a laser on solving problems at home, sometimes to the detriment of his foreign policy execution. Aaron David Miller is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
First, it distracts him. It makes him stubbornly and I think willfully focused on turning his attention to what he wants to do, and that is to become a transformative president at home.
Katulis said some long-term problems at the State Department have likely also played a role. Congress may also be partly to blame, Christopher Skaluba of the Atlantic Council told VOA. Blinken, who grew up in Paris, has vowed to work hard to restore the close U.S. relationship with France, saying it will take some time. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A United Nations analysis of documented killings in Syria's decade-long war finds that roughly 350,000 civilians died between March 2011, when the conflict erupted, and March 2021. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights commissioned the analysis and has submitted the results to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The High Commissioner's Office suspended counting of civilian war deaths in 2014. It was stopped because gathering verifiable information had become more complex and dangerous. In its last update, the office reported more than 191,000 individuals had been killed. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says the current number of more than 350,000 conflict-related deaths is based on her agency's data, information gathered by civil society organizations, and from the Syrian government.
Our numbers include only those people identifiable by full name, with an established date of death, and who died in an identified governorate. But is it not, and should we not see as a complete number of conflict-related killings in Syria during this period? It indicates a minimum verifiable number and is certainly an undercount of the actual number of killings.
The greatest number of documented killings was recorded in Aleppo, followed by rural Damascus, Homs, Idlib, Hama, and Tartus. The report finds more than 1 in 13 victims was a woman and nearly 1 in 13 was a child. Bachelet says it is important to recognize that each number represents a person, not just an anonymous statistic in a brutal war. Tragically, she says, many other victims have left behind no witnesses or documentation as to their deaths and the lives they led.
Behind each recorded death was a human being, born free and equal, in dignity and rights. We must always make victim stories visible, both individually and collectively, because the injustice and horror of each of those deaths should compel us to action.
Bachelet says her office has begun to apply established statistical estimation techniques to account for the numbers of missing people. That, she notes, will provide a more complete picture of the scale of the conflict and its impact on Syrians. The Syrian conflict has sparked the world's biggest refugee crisis, with an estimated 6.8 million refugees and asylum seekers, most in neighboring countries. Another 6.7 million people are displaced inside Syria. The combined total of more than 13.5 million forcibly displaced people amounts to more than half of Syria's population. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Korea has urged North Korea to reactivate cross-border communication lines between the neighboring countries. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The move comes a day after North Korea repeated an offer to open conditional talks. Kim Yo-jung, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, had said the previous day that if South Korea abandons hostile policies, talks could resume. She didn't elaborate on what specific steps she wants South Korea to take, but many believe the North wants South Korea to help with sanctions relief from the U.S. The warming atmosphere comes weeks after North Korea carried out its first missile test in 6 months. I'm Karen Chamas.
This is the Voice of America. Global shoppers face possible shortages of smartphones and other goods ahead of Christmas after power cuts to meet government targets forced Chinese factories to shut down and left some households in the dark. In the northeastern city of Luoyang, 23 people were hospitalized with gas poisoning after ventilation in a metal casing factory was shut off following a power outage, according to state broadcaster CCTV. No deaths were reported. Switzerland has voted by a wide margin to allow same-sex couples to marry, bringing the Alpine nation into line with many others in Western Europe. Official results show that the measure passed in a referendum on Sunday with 64.1% of votes. It won a majority in all of Switzerland's 26 cantons or states. Switzerland's parliament and the governing federal council supported the, quote, marriage for all, unquote, measure. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Top Iraqi government officials are rejecting calls by a group of 300 prominent tribal leaders and other past and present dignitaries at a meeting in Iraqi Kurdistan city of Erbil to normalize ties with Israel. The Iraqi Prime Minister's office issued a statement Saturday calling the meeting, which took place Friday, quote, illegal, unquote. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iraqi TV reported Saturday afternoon that Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi's office issued a statement rejecting a call by a group of 300 dignitaries to normalize ties with Israel. It added that the statement called the meeting, which took place Friday in the Kurdish capital of Erbil, illegal. Arab media indicated that Parliament Speaker Mohammed Halbousi and one of his deputies are also rejecting the call, along with Iraqi President Barham Saleh. The meeting was sponsored by a U.S. peace advocacy group led by Joseph Browde, a Jewish American whose family fled Baghdad during the 1940s. Browde told the conference that those gathered in Erbil have made a courageous decision. He says that he supports the efforts of courageous leaders from six Iraqi provinces, Baghdad, Anbar, Mosul, Salahuddin, Babel, and Diyala, declaring with conviction their desire to enter into the framework of the Abrahamic Accords between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. The head of the Sunni Sahwa movement, Wissam Hardan, told the conference that Iraq's federal system permitted different regions to express their support for normalizing ties with Israel. He says that given Iraq's federal system of government, various parties are expressing their desire to normalize ties with Israel and tighten relations with the Israeli people. Paul Sullivan, a Washington-based Middle East analyst, tells VOA that the meeting in Erbil to discuss Iraq improving ties with Israel caused an uproar in Baghdad, but that it could be a sign of things to come. It could be an indication that the views on Israel are changing in some quarters of Iraq. Sullivan added that the Kurds who hosted the Friday conference to normalize ties with Israel have always been more open to Israel than other populations in Iraq. Several Kurdish leaders backtracked on the conference after hearing of opposition from Baghdad, however, claiming that they weren't aware of the exact nature of the conference and that its organizers misled those attending about its intent. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV, which covered the meeting, suggested that it may be intended to test the waters inside Iraq for public reaction to normalizing ties with Israel. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Israeli troops killed four Hamas militants in a gun battle during raids on Sunday against one of the group's cells in the occupied West Bank, an Israeli military spokesman said. Hamas confirmed the men were members. Lucy Field of Reuters reports.
Israeli troops killed at least four Hamas militants in gun battles on Sunday, in raids against one of the group's cells in the occupied West Bank. That's according to an Israeli military spokesman, who said an Israeli officer and a soldier were also critically wounded, and four more Palestinians arrested. Israeli officials have long said Hamas, which runs the Gaza Strip, intends to gain strength in the West Bank, so it can challenge its rival there, the Western-backed Palestinian Authority. This Palestinian resident of the village of Beit Anan heard the raid before dawn and says he saw soldiers carrying two bodies. The shootouts marked the most serious violence between Israel and Hamas since an 11-day Gaza war in May, and threatened to raise tensions in the West Bank and along the Israeli border with Gaza. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas accused Israel of, quote, field executions against our people. Hamas spokesman confirmed the men were members of the group, which Israel and the West regard as a terrorist organization. Hamas called on Palestinians in the West Bank to, quote, escalate resistance against the occupier in all areas. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, en route to the UN in New York, said the Hamas men were, quote, about to carry out terrorist attacks.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said Monday that Iran had breached all the, quote, red lines, unquote, aimed at curbing its nuclear weapons program. In his first speech before United Nations General Assembly, Bennett went to say Israel, quote, will not allow, unquote, Tehran to get a bomb. Iran says its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes only. Indian farmers opposed to reforms they say threaten their livelihoods aim to renew their push against the changes, with nationwide protests on Monday, a year after laws to liberalize regulation of the sector were introduced. Soraya Ali of Reuters reports.
Indian farmers took to the streets once again on Monday in nationwide protests, 1 year on since the government introduced reforms which they say threaten their livelihood. Video footage showed police clashing with protesters in the city of Chennai as they tried to force barricades down. Others were forcibly detained. Tens of thousands of farmers have camped out on major highways around the capital, New Delhi, since the legislation was introduced in September last year. The new law allows farmers to sell produce to buyers beyond government-regulated wholesale markets where growers are assured of a minimum price. Small farmers say the changes make them vulnerable to competition from big business and that they could eventually lose price supports for staples like wheat and rice. The government says the reforms mean new opportunities and better prices for farmers. Earlier this month, more than 500,000 farmers attended a rally in Uttar Pradesh. It was the biggest yet in the protest campaign to step up pressure on Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government to repeal the laws. The protests have been generally peaceful, but police and farmers clashed in New Delhi in January during a tractor procession. One protester was killed and more than 80 police were injured.
That's Soraya Ali of Reuters. The Cumbre Vieja volcano in the Spanish Canary Islands continued to spew lava and debris 1 week after it erupted and forced thousands of people to flee their homes. A local airport has reopened, but planes remain grounded as ash clogs runways and lava fills the skies. VOA's Arash Rabasadi has more.
Drone images show lava running down the Cumbre Vieja volcano as the eruption wreaks havoc on the Canary island of La Palma. Satellite imagery shows the eruption from space. On Sunday, Pope Francis spoke of the disaster from Vatican City.
I express closeness and solidarity to those affected by the eruption. I'm thinking especially of those forced to leave their homes, for these people so tried by sufferings, and for the rescuers. We pray to the Madonna venerated on that island as Our Lady of Snows.
Spain's National Geographical and Mining Institute says its drones captured these images of the volcano's cone collapsing under its own weight. La Palma is home to more than 83,000 people, and around 6,000 have been forced to evacuate since lava began devouring their homes last week. Donation centers like this one at a local sports complex have sprung up to distribute food and clothes. And those searching for a way off the island encountered long lines at ferry terminals as the airport remained closed until Sunday. Ash on the runways and lava spewing into the sky mean that for now, planes will remain on the ground. Authorities report no fatalities or serious injuries from the eruption, but as much as 15% of the island's banana crops could be at risk, threatening thousands who depend on the industry for work. Farmers warn that lava flowing to the sea could affect irrigation pipes for the entire region. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu from Washington. Thank you so much for listening.